Hey, welcome back to Section. Today we'll be talking about security, part one, as you learned from Dan like a week ago. Here's our agenda. Even though it looks like it's a lot of stuff, I think it should be fun and hopefully broken down in easier bits to swallow or to, I guess. That didn't animate. That's sad. So first, before we can get into the details, we should probably talk about how files are organized. As you heard from Dan, they're written sort of in chunks all over your hard disk, and there are different sectors. How do you link them all? Well, he talked about this thing called file allocation table, or FAT, FAT, I guess. And you can sort of think, like, here's a visual example that hopefully, if you're a bit confused, maybe this will help you. Let's say that's a platter on your hard disk drive. And then let's say that's the FAT. It's really small here, but rest assured, in your computer, it's probably like much bigger. It has more detail. It's not just file and location. This is a simplification. So let's say I was doing this Section 7 PowerPoint, right? And its location in memory is that thing there that happens to say dead beef. But so let's say in your hard disk, if you can see the little blue dot, let's say it starts there, and then the FAT pretty much stores the location on disk, so whenever you want to reference it, it'll know where on the disk to go to. So you can start writing there on that little sector, and then as you or I, work on the PowerPoint or the file, and it becomes bigger and it needs more space, it saves. There's more stuff to save. It takes up more space in the disk, like so. And let's say at some point I stop and I decide to go play a game. And for game files, this isn't really standard. You probably don't need to know this. There's something called a .sav, save, game save. So let's say I start playing a video game instead of finishing my PowerPoint. Oh, no. So let's say this gets stored on memory somewhere over there, where the orange dot starts. So I play, and I start saving. I get a lot of stuff in my inventory or something, and then it takes up that sector. And let's say I feel guilty at some point and figure, oh, maybe I better start working on my PowerPoint. So I go back to my PowerPoint and I start working on it again. I get more slides, I save more, it takes up more space. What happens, say, when, as you can see, the blue part meets the orange part, and then there's no more contiguous space. How do I resolve that? Well, what in a rudimentary way, visually, what your computer does is it sort of links the two. Links, quote unquote, very simplified version here. It actually, I think it stores the data of the end of the chunks, each of the chunks. It stores the beginning and the end of each and where they link to. So this is a simplification. So let's say my blue file has gotten bigger. I can't save it over the orange file, because that would be deleting my data. So it sort of links to or remembers that it's stored, the data afterwards is stored in another location. So all is well, I keep working on my PowerPoint, it gets bigger, it gets saved, maybe all the way around, or maybe I have other files and it starts saving in different spots. Probably see how this might lead to fragmentation, where one whole file is broken up and then sort of scattered all over your hard disk, and you're like, oh no, they're not contiguous. Since your hard drive platter is hardware, it's not like electrical. Maybe I should turn that off. It takes longer for that head to sort of seek out all the pieces that are distributed all over your platter. So as you can see, fragmentation could be a problem. It could slow down your computer. As I said, it's just when chunks of data from a file, from a single file, is not contiguous, it's all scattered over your platter or your hard drive. And then you'd have slower access time because it's not contiguous. You can't just continuously read it as the disk spins around. You'd have to move the head to some other part and then move it back and forth. So, how do you solve this problem? You defrag, or defragmentation. That's where you rearrange the bits and pieces so that they're all contiguous. So you can just read it sort of straight around the platter as it spins. Oh. So how your computer might go about doing this is, say we have our disk with all these fragments in color. What it probably does is it rearranges your memory. So let's say it copies this yellow bit to some other spot that's not occupied. And then it can proceed to sort of copy in the contents, the rest of the file that should have been like connected. So yay, now you can just read the blue file sort of straight as the disk spins. Yes. Cool, so that was our little aside about fragmentation and defragmentation. You should probably do that on your computer every so often just to make all your files stored contiguously in memory and then possibly go faster. Going back to what we were talking about before, say you had you wanted to get rid of your hard drive or whatever. How do you get rid of the data stored on your hard drive because you don't want your friends getting your information? So there's this thing called formatting a drive, which, when you try to do it, I tried this last night, not that I formatted anything, I just wanted to see the warning message. It says something like, warning, formatting will erase all the data on this disk. To format the disk, click OK, otherwise click cancel. So this is sort of misleading, because it says it will erase all the data on the disk, but as Dan told us, that's not quite the case. When you format a drive, it actually just deletes the table, the FAT, the references. So as you can see, that got deleted in my little animation. But the references are gone, but the data is still there. Like, your disk still looks like this. You just don't have the arrows, you don't have the like memory locations, maybe not the file names. Data is still there. Oh no, so if you give it to your friend, they might be able to... So what? So what if I give this to my friend? Well, it's still accessible. If you had something to like read the data off, you could probably reconstruct those files. And then how this is possible is because certain files have like certain headers. They begin a certain way. Like, I think bitmap files begin with the ASCII characters B and M, for bitmap, I guess, short. So if you wanted to find a bitmap file, you might look around for that header and be like, oh, cool, here's the start of a bitmap file. I'm going to go read in the rest of the file and then see what it is. Other files like JPEGs have this certain like chunk in the beginning that they, that starts off the JPEG files. I'm sure other files have that too. So here's sort of a visualization of how one might, read this data without the table. So as I said before, certain files have specific headers, certain patterns, certain sequences when they begin. And if you could find that header, so if you're just sort of reading off the disk, if you could find that header, you can reconstruct the files. So let's say we have this reader thing that's going to be this gray blob on the screen. But in reality, you'd have some sort of like machinery that, that isn't probably a gray blob. Probably a read-write head. So let's say our gray blob moves around, and then it finds the beginning of, say, a PowerPoint. Let's say it finds a PowerPoint header. It's like, oh, cool, I found something. Now I'm going to start reading all the data, starting from that point. And then maybe, it has some sort of notion of, oh, this is the end of the sector, or maybe, this is a different file, or maybe it just keeps reading into the file. But anyway, it reads. And let's say it recognizes, oh, another header. And let's say this, it knows, or it... maybe it has this pattern recognition and it realizes this belongs to .save. And then it'll start sort of reading in from there. And then you can sort of imagine this thing, this reader, checking out all of your disk and then analyzing it in such a way that it can sort of patch up all the little bits and pieces and put them together and reconstruct your files. Oh no! Then they can probably, open it up and see what's in this PowerPoint or this .sav. Find my game files, see where I was, see where I died. Anyway, aside from that, that's how if you format your computer, the data is still there. Like companies and other programs can sort of retrieve this data in a similar sort of fashion. So yeah, just because you format it and it says all data will be erased, you know, don't believe that. Like how you shouldn't believe that images can be enhanced from last week. Anyway, just one of those lies, I guess they tell you. But so we have this problem. Data is still on the disk. How do I really delete this? Like, what? Well, I guess, as Dan said, and I guess it might probably be obvious in common sense, physical destruction. If you guys have watched Office Max, here's a scene where they're destroying a printer, so they're not really, you know, they're not really destroying data, I guess. But yeah, you should probably do something like this. You can get your friends together and like destroy stuff, vent some anger. It could be fun. I don't know, I haven't destroyed anything yet. You know, I like my computers. Get along. Or you can also use programs to write nonsense data everywhere on your disk. So what I mean by nonsense data, you can zero it out, i.e. put zeros everywhere, so everything's like zero. Or you can just write like random ones and zeros, since they're like random. They don't really belong to any of your data, and they'll overwrite what you had there before. So, you know, random stuff, zero it out. I guess you could like stick ones in there, but And then there are a few programs to do this. Here are some that Dan went over. DBAN. Like, I haven't had to do any of this stuff yet, so I haven't, like, I don't have a recommendation for you guys since I haven't actually tried them. Apparently for Macs, there's this secure erase thing. And then there was this question that I thought was particularly interesting. So if on my computer I'm running this program to erase the hard drive, how can it run the erasing program? Because it's like, it's sort of like the ring of snakes eating each other. You're running this program on your computer, but you're simultaneously possibly erasing it as well. What? Well, to solve this conundrum, I guess, if you want to call it that, there's this thing called a boot disk. That's basically sort of, I guess you can think of it as a disk or maybe flash drive or some sort of other medium where you can run an operating system. So you can sort of have like a side computer brain thing over here running the erasing program while it erases it on your computer. So yeah, you're not like erasing the program as you're erasing your drive. That's kind of, it's kind of weird. So yeah, I thought that was a particularly interesting question, but now you know if you were wondering. Hee hee. Cool. Any questions on how to destroy your hard drive? If you want, you can send it to me and I'll like physically destroy it or try to. Could be interesting. I don't know. I never tried before. Anyway, so another thing that Dan emphasized in lecture was that if someone has your computer, like physically has your computer, like maybe they stole it from you, maybe you went to the bathroom and they're like, oh, cool, no one's here. I'm going to, you know, mess with it or something. If someone has it, then they pretty much have free reign with your data, right? They can... You know, they can look at all your files, they can open up things, they can copy things onto a flash drive and take it away with them before you come back from the bathroom. That's pretty scary. But, and then he also mentioned how passwords do hinder, like, on my laptop here, if I don't do anything for, say, like, 15 minutes, it sort of, the screen goes blank, and then when you try to start it up again, it asks you to log in. So things like that hinder, you know, like, hinder a random person walking around like, oh, cool, laptop unattended, I'm going to do weird stuff. But it's not fail-safe. Like, I wish I could do the demo for you, but I went to my cousin's house, and he's maybe a bigger techie hacker, whatever you want to call him, than I am. And he was like, because he really wanted to get at my computer. And I'm like, haha, I have a password, you can't do that, right? No. Like, I went to the bathroom, he, like, fiddled around on it, and then I came back, and he was like, he had this big grin. I was like, what? He's like, oh, I logged you out. And I'm like, what? So I logged back in, and then like, he used this program that got like my password, but he didn't account for like capitalization. So I'll just tell you guys, not that I hope you guys will try, but the first letter of my password starts with a P, right? He saw it as a lowercase p, but it was actually an uppercase P, and he had like my entire password. It's just that one capitalization thing that, you know, threw him off. So don't tell him, otherwise he'll, well, I guess I could just change my password, but yeah, that was scary. What? He had my password. He could like, I don't know, do weird stuff with my computer. I was pretty upset. But anyway, let's not tell him. Shh. Case sensitivity is good. Maybe I should put some numbers too. Well, actually, I have those. So yeah, passwords hinder, but they're not fail, you know, fail safe. Definitely can be, you know, found out. I guess if you forgot your password, you might bring your laptop to Best Buy or something and be like, hey, I can't like access my computer, and I'm sure they'll find a way to, you know, let you back into your computer. So you can probably think about if someone stole your computer, they might take the same route, seeing that, oh, this is my computer. But anyway, not fail-safe. Just wanted to say that. And so a reason why if someone has your computer, you're kind of in trouble if they have malicious intent is because the data stored on your hard disk is normally unencrypted. What does this mean? That means, well, you know, if they have access to your computer, they can just open stuff up and look at it. I know that seems kind of weird, but, well, not weird, but maybe commonplace or very common sensey, but you can actually encrypt your data such that unless they have the key or they know a password, they won't be able to like open that file, they won't be able to like read it. So as I guess Dan went more into detail about this today, but encryption data plus key equals, yay, encrypted data. So unless you have the key or unless you have this, you know, neat way of figuring out the key, you know, the other person who doesn't have the key shouldn't be able to read your data. And whenever you want to use your data, you just, you know, stick that key in there, I guess, and then you get your, like, unencrypted data out to do whatever you want. So yay, data encryption! But of course this takes time and, you know, I'm not sure about you guys, I'm kind of impatient, so you might not want to encrypt your entire, you know, entire memory in your computer. Like Dan said, you might not want to encrypt all your movies that are like several gigabytes, really big. That would take a while. And so yeah, there's a trade-off, a cost, I guess. Yay, so let's talk a bit about encrypting, or talk more about encrypting, I guess. So a few programs that Dan mentioned for encryption is, for Mac, FileVault. So I haven't personally tried these either, because I guess I'm happy-go-lucky and kind of hope my cousin won't try to break into my laptop again. But anyway, for the Mac, apparently there's FileVault, which Dan said only worked for the home directory, not like your entire computer. So whatever you think is very important and you want to encrypt, you don't want other people to see, you should probably put in your home directory and, you know, let FileVault take care of that. Apparently for PC, there is something called TrueCrypt, and it encrypts a section on your hard drive, so you sort of specify or you make a section on your hard drive, and then I guess you tell it, hey, you know, here's a little section, maybe a partition or something, encrypt only stuff here. So you can move all the stuff you want to be, you know, secure onto that little section, and then it'll just, you know, do it there and not your entire computer, which, you know, might take a whole lot of time. Like I said, I'm impatient, so yay, TrueCrypt. Maybe I should try that. And then Dan also mentioned that you should encrypt your backups, because it seems kind of silly if you, like me, I have this external hard drive that I just sort of plug in every now and then and sort of sync it, or make sure everything on my laptop is also on the hard drive in case my laptop dies. You guys should totally do backups in case your, you know, your computer dies and you're like, oh no, my final project. You know, it was like 25 pages and now it's all gone and I have to start over and it's due tomorrow. That would be pretty bad, right? So backups are good, but it'd be kind of silly if you made a backup and then you encrypted the original on your laptop, and then someone went along and got your external hard drive and they were like, oh, I wonder what's on here, and then they opened it up and everything was there for them to see. That'd be pretty, you know, sensitive information or files might, you know, that might be a bad thing. Or, I mean, it is a bad thing. You don't want other people getting sensitive information of yours. And a lot of people also tend to store their data on the web, you know, as opposed to like, or backups on the web. I think Dan mentioned like Dropbox. I should get into using that because I hear it's really good. But if you do store your stuff on the web, you, you know, probably should encrypt that too if it's sensitive information or data that you don't really want random people to be able to like look at and be like, oh, no, cool, this person, I don't know, has this thing on the web. So yeah, encryption is good. But if you do too much of it, you know, maybe there's a cost, there's a trade-off. Yay! So moving on, let's talk about authentication. So let's say you're getting on the web. What kind of security measures are there on the web to stop like other people from accessing your data, say your email or something like that? Well, I'm sure you guys all know there are passwords. You know, these are, well, okay, those are some tips. Passwords, you know, just a string of characters that hopefully only you know and remember. Well, you and like the server and, you know, whatever you're trying to use know. And then they, whenever you try to log into something, you provide them a password. If it's the correct one, then yay, you should be you. The person trying to log in should be you, right? So here are some tips that Dan gave, and I mean, I definitely agree with him. You shouldn't use the same password for all of your logins. Well, that's because if, say, one site gets compromised, or maybe there's just like a silly site where your password isn't encrypted, or it's treated not very like safely, not very securely. If one person gets that password, they might try it on your other accounts, and if they can get in, that would be pretty bad. So yeah, for me personally, I have like several different, like different level of security passwords. Like if it's for like a silly little game that maybe my friend made, I'll have like this five character password. That's just like, well, if anyone finds out, it doesn't really matter because it's a silly little game. But and then I use like longer ones, harder to guess, I guess, ones for like Gmail and Amazon, because that'd be pretty scary to have someone else figure that out. But yeah. And then another tip would be to not keep all of them in one place. You know, don't write them all on a sticky and then, you know, stick it on your computer screen or on your desk, or like, you know, maybe even on your whiteboard. That'd be pretty bad. Someone walks in and they're like, oh, cool, what's all this stuff? I'm gonna start trying it. Okay, that would be bad. You know, I'm sure it's a lot of common sense. Don't do this stuff. Is there another tip? Okay, cool. So before we go to that, for your passwords, you should probably choose something longish and with numbers, capitalization, punctuation if they give it to you. Because to my knowledge, how people go about trying to crack passwords is, the naive way would be to have some sort of program that tries every possible combination of characters. So to sort of try to see if that's your password and try to get into there. So a smarter version might, you know, try every word in the dictionary. And since a computer is doing this systematically, you know, like someone's not actually sitting there typing all these things in, because that would be tedious. But since since our program is doing it, you know, you can sort of see how a bad person could just run it and sort of leave and do other stuff and come back and be like, oh, cool, this password worked. And, you know, then they'd have your password. So if you put in, like, words that aren't really in the dictionary, if you combine words, if you have, like, numbers and punctuation, it becomes much harder to try to guess those passwords. It becomes much harder to try to, like, brute force, i.e. just try every combination possible to get your password. So, yeah, that's why websites nowadays sort of, some of them require that you have, like, at least one number or, you know, one of these punctuation characters, or like capitalization. Like I remember back in the day when I signed up for Gmail, like they allowed me to have a 5-letter password with no numbers and no capitalization. And for a while I was still using it till I was like, wait, this might be a bad, you know, might be a bad thing. Maybe I should like update my password. But I'm pretty sure they don't let you do that anymore now. So now they require certain things. But yay, web has gotten safer, I think. In that aspect, I guess, if you want to think about it like that. So passwords, kind of obvious form of authentication. That's weird. Why is it going backwards? That was really weird. Magic. Okay, so there's another form of authentication, which I think is pretty cool, that Dan talked about. Two-factor authentication. So as the name suggests, you know, two things as opposed to just a password or just a PIN. So yeah, you just use another method or mechanism to prove that you are you. So Dan sort of mentioned his little physical key thing that generated numbers. A few other examples are like, say, your fingerprint. I guess, you know, that brings to my mind things like top security level and like Minority Report eyeball checking, retina checking. But I guess fingerprinting, it happens. Also maybe sending your phone a text, because, you know, ideally you'd have your phone and only you would have your phone, and then once you get the text with the PIN or whatever, you can, you know, type it into the website and be like, ah, yes, this is me, I have my phone, I am me. There's also maybe a bit less, well, another sort of spin off of that would be emailing you some sort of PIN or some sort of number. That way, you know, the idea is that only you have access to your email, and then, you know, from there you can log in. So an example of this, so I have this application called Steam. It's, you can probably guess, a gaming application where it like stores all of my games in one place so that if I, you know, get a new computer, I don't have to like buy other copies of the games or whatever. So here they just recently implemented this thing where whenever you access your account from a new computer, so they apparently have my computers on file somewhere, hopefully encrypted, they'll send you an email with this little, they call it a special access code. Here it's NA9Q6. And then you have to put that into the website. Like, it actually prompts you, hey, we emailed you. You know, where's the PIN? So then you actually have to stick this into their, you know, their little prompt, and then you can, you know, access it. So as you can tell, I've gotten several emails from them here, and you can sort of see that their PIN changes each time, you know, you try to access a different computer, or yeah. So it's not a static PIN. So if someone was trying to like sort of guess this, it probably changes every time it emails you, or maybe a certain time frame that, oh cool, maybe there's a certain time frame that they, you know, update this. But yeah, I think this is awesome because it would be terrible for someone to like hack into my little gaming account and steal all my games and change my password, and then I wouldn't have any more games to play. Wouldn't that be sad? Well, I mean, I'd be sad. Maybe you guys won't be. Maybe you'll be like, oh, now Rose can spend more time on, I don't know, whatever else, her schoolwork or something. I mean, I do my schoolwork, but, you know, you gotta relax sometimes, right? I don't spend whole weekends playing video games. That was high school. Anyway, let's go back to more pertinent stuff and not my personal life. Okay, so another danger of the internet is this thing called session hijacking. What the heck is that? Hijacking what? Session what? Okay, so let's set the scene here. Say you've logged in, cool, password authentication, two-factor authentication, whatever. It's done, yay. You're you. Some random person is not you. So most websites sort of remember who you are by a cookie, which is, okay, you can sort of think of it as a hand stamp. It's a form of identification, prolonged identification, I guess. It's actually some piece of text that the server puts on your computer to sort of identify your computer, saying, oh, cool, you've visited before, you know, sort of acts so that you stay logged in and then your preferences are there, or like it knows what you've seen, what you haven't seen, you know, things like that. So it knows that you're you. That way you don't have to log in like every other page or every page. That'd be kind of annoying. So it sends this text that should be put on your computer, the cookie, via the HTTP headers, and then just keep that in mind, sends it through the headers. And then when you revisit the site, as I said before, your computer sends the cookie to the server, and the server's like, oh, cool, I know you. You know, we're best buddies. Here's all your preferences or whatever. So, problem here. We call that HTTP headers can be seen by others. That means, you know, if you're sitting in an internet cafe or whatever, and you're sending out, you know, this information, someone might be able to look at your cookie that's in your header and maybe impersonate you. Oh, no. That's really bad, right? Say I had a cookie that had like the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm just like surfing around, and that's not secure, that's not encrypted or whatever. Someone else, you know, sort of grabs that header and they're like, oh, cool, look, her cookie is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm gonna use the same cookie and, you know, go to the same website and I'm gonna be her. Oh no. So before Facebook and some other websites implemented some security measures, you could actually use this fire sheep thing that Dan's been talking about to like be a person like in their Facebook. Like you could actually not really log in, but you can like be them. You can use their cookie to sort of have access to their account. So cookies, they're not necessarily a bad thing, but you should probably, you know, have some sort of security. So yeah, as I was talking about fire sheep, if you want, you can like Google it. So to my understanding, fire sheep was created because there was a security hole, and I think a group of people were trying to like advocate for security to sort of, patch up this hole, right? And no one would like listen to them because they're like, oh, whatever, it's just these people. Who's ever gonna do that? So they're like, okay, you know what? We're gonna make fire sheep. Now everyone can do it. Now you need to patch your security hole. So to my understanding, that's how the story goes. So it's not like a mean thing or an evil thing to release fire sheep. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. They were just trying to inform the public and move people to action, companies to action, move Facebook to action. Not just Facebook, other websites as well, Twitter and stuff like that. So yeah, to my understanding, it was a good thing. So yeah, don't use it for bad things, because then, that's, I can't, don't want you guys to do that. That's bad. Anyway, okay, so scary stuff happens on the web, right? Okay, so how do we defend ourselves? How do we like do this securely and don't have people impersonating us and stealing our data and all this stuff? Well, HTTPS, HTTP secure. As Dan mentioned, this is using it's combination protocol. So HTTP is a protocol, right, to access the web and the whole request and response thing. It also involves SSL, which sort of encrypts everything that goes through it, I guess, if you want to think about it like that. So it's a combination of protocols. It encrypts your requests and like your responses and stuff. So technically, it should be good. Data's encrypted. People can't, even if they could steal your cookie, they don't know how to like un or decrypt that cookie to actually use, the actual key or the actual like cookie data to impersonate you. So yay, that's good, right? So yeah, as I said, even though others can see your requests, maybe they can see your encrypted data, they can't really, like open it up. They can't really unencrypt it and use the real thing. That's good, yeah. So your risk is reduced, but Dan sort of had some warnings about how, maybe from you to the first server or the first router, it might be encrypted. Maybe afterwards, it's not encrypted anymore. So it's, your risk is reduced from the whole like, if you're sitting in a cafe, from the people around in the cafe, but maybe elsewhere, someone might be able to access your data. So, not also not fail-safe, but yeah, just you should probably know that. And if you're interested, for those who are using Firefox, you can have every page, more or less, of yours be use HTTPS. That way, wherever you go, you're more or less, your data is like encrypted. So if you want to be, super paranoid or whatever, you can use this. This is what all my friends were using once they found out about Fire Sheep and before Facebook switched to HTTPS, like everywhere on their site. This was apparently the way to go. But I think they're trying to do something for Chrome, but it's not quite as good as its plugin for Firefox. So yay, Firefox! I like Firefox. They're coming out with a new browser or something. I heard it was like super cool. Not that I have preference for anything, IE and Netscape are good too. Safari. Cool. So hopefully, with this information, you guys can like better protect yourselves, lower your risks. Interesting. Yay! Magic. Cool. So that was how to securely surf the web. Going off on a tangent, how do you anonymously surf the web? Say your enemy has access to all your headers and stuff like that, and then you don't want them to know, where you're going or where's this data getting sent from, where are you getting data from. How would you do that? So this is sort of a separate problem from security, kind of, because this is just anonymously. Maybe your data doesn't have to be secure, but you just don't want people to know where it's going and where it's coming from. Well, I give you this winky face because for those who've been watching, you probably know what I'm going to say now. So I'm just going to sort of breeze through this. One thing is Tor, the onion router. So Dan mentioned this, and I was like, hee hee, I talked about it before he did. Yes. Anyway, small win for me, or whatever. We're a team, we don't fight, or whatever. So the basic idea is there's you send your data to some machine. Like they have this whole network of machines. I think they're volunteer machines, so I guess if you had a server machine or something, you could sign up for this. But you send your data to a machine, And that machine, like, you know, sort of sends it to another machine, and it sort of gets spread out sort of throughout this network. And then one of those machines will connect to the website that you want. And then, you know, it sort of comes back to you through, like, another hopping path. Yay, so I guess someone looking at this might see that you're sending data to this random machine in, like, I don't know, Italy or something, while you're actually trying to access, like, Facebook. So that's kind of cool, right? They don't know where you're going. Can't really trace your IP, I guess. Well, and anyway. And then there's proxies, which I've also talked about. To my understanding, most proxies, at least like web proxies, where it's all in your browser. I showed you an example or two maybe a week ago or something, or 2 weeks ago. It's basically you send your request to some other machine, and the machine acts on your behalf to send that request to like Facebook.com or whatever, and when it gets the data back, it sends it back to you. So there's like sort of like this middle machine that hopefully is trustworthy and doesn't do anything weird. That way it looks like you're sending it to the other machine and you know, you're not actually trying to access Facebook or YouTube at work or whatever. So yeah, that's another way to be anonymous. And something we've been sort of preaching about a lot, VPN. And as you already know, you create a secure tunnel to your VPN client, and it's encrypted, so even better. Not only is it anonymous, at least anonymous for the people in between you and the VPN client, it's also encrypted, so it's also safer. Yay! But yeah, so anonymous. Not quite the same as security, but I guess if you want to be super paranoid, you can do like HTTPS everywhere and use like Tor proxy or VPN. Your machine might like slow down quite a bit. But I don't know. Trade-offs. Cool, so yay, let's get on and talk about. Okay, so we've been talking about what you guys can do or how you know, what you do might compromise, you know, your data. There's also things that the server, which you know you can't really do. I guess you can like email them and advocate or you know, advocate for making things more secure or something like that. But here's a little bit from the server side. One attack that Dan mentioned last week was SQL injection attack. What does that mean? It's big, maybe it looks scary, but we can do this. So yeah, if we break this down, SQL, it's a database language. Injection, you know, you put something, you know, you inject something, you put something where maybe it shouldn't be, and attack, you know, malicious. So, you know, as I said, in a simplified way, you insert some malicious code that gets like executed, or you sort of alter this command that gets executed, and then bad things kind of happen. So the general idea is you mess with some site's database, you mess with the database, maybe you erase all their data, maybe you grab all their usernames, maybe you grab all their usernames and passwords. That's a general idea, because I think Dan went into like a lot of detail from what I recall. But don't worry, I'll get into a little bit of detail. And maybe you guys won't get this right now, but hopefully you'll get this in a few slides. It's from XKCD. It's called The Exploits of a Mom. So there's his mom. Hi, this is your son's school. We're having some computer trouble. Oh dear, did he break something? In a way. Did you really name your son Robert, single quote, parenthesis, semicolon, drop table student, semicolon, question mark? Oh yes, little Bobby Tables, we call him. Well, we've lost this year's student records. I hope you're happy. And I hope you've learned to sanitize your database inputs. So the joke here is that the school probably saw this student's name, this sort of weird-looking syntax sort of Robert drop table students thing, and they probably tried to stick it in their database without realizing that it's really weird-looking and it might do bad things. And then they probably executed that, and then it dropped their table. Dropped, i.e. delete. So now, oh no, they don't have any more, you know, information about their students. It's all gone. Why? So yeah, that's, like this actually, you could do it in real life, but there's security, obviously. There's ways to, that the server and the server that can sort of prevent this. Okay, so to sort of understand this little joke, I'm going to give you a bit of background. Hopefully it won't be too dry, too like boring, whatever. It's just a little bit of background. So to store data, most websites use like databases. It's sort of like a giant Excel spreadsheet. It organizes your data. You can organize by rows, columns, depending on your database. So you can just think of it, giant spreadsheet to organize data, has important data like usernames, passwords, things like that. And then to change this data or interact with this data, say you wanted to pick everyone who was female out of, see who the female, your female clients are. You can sort of issue a command, something like, hey, get me, everyone whose gender is female. So, you can issue these commands, these statements to change or interact with this data in your database. So there are things like insert, select, delete, update, and there's like some syntax that I'm not going to go into, that I think Dan sort of went into. But just know that there are these commands and statements that you can use to sort of manipulate the data or interact with the data. So you can maybe, hopefully this isn't too far a jump ahead, but if you or some malicious person can anticipate the command, you can possibly craft user input to mess with. What I mean by this is, demo, maybe I should show. So let's say here's a bit of code that I actually use in some of my websites. Of course, I sort of changed a few things. So a SQL command could look something like this: select, UID, a column title from a table, users, where the username is, some variable here and password some variable here. Right? So that's a command that you could give. Do the demo in a little bit. And then let's say, as you can probably tell or imagine, these variables are inputted by the user. So when you get to a login page, okay, just let me do the demo now, I guess. Okay, so here's my login page. As you can sort of tell, when you, the user, type something into these inputs, they're taken and they're sort of processed, like something happens to them. That something might be this. They might check the database for your username and your password to grab your data and, display it to you or something like that. So going from this, you can craft an injection attack by, sort of first, realizing that these two are sort of in your control. And if you sort of anticipate that this is the code or the command that they're using, you can imagine that, oh, hey, why don't I, give a username here, someone that exists, me, because, apparently I joined this, and maybe the password, why don't I put a bit of code in there or like parts of a command in there, and this is in blue, something like password, it can be whatever, it doesn't have to be IDK. IDK short for I don't know. And then you have this piece of code or command that says or 1 = 1. Well, 1 obviously = 1, and since it's or, even though this is not true, this will be true, and since it's or, it makes both of it true. So when you execute this, you can sort of guess that the website now thinks that you're Rose, me, and just to be cool, why don't we try this? Okay, so first let me show you the little demo, and I made this little like wall posty thing comment where you can you can type something, hit post. Okay, so I'm not logged in, so it only lets you post if you're logged in. Here you can sort of see other people, quote unquote, have posted. Little in jokes, Happy Cat, GLaDOS, for all you gaming Portal fans. Anyway, just to show you it works, let's log in as me. Poor password, I know, 3 characters, but this is a demo. Okay, what do you want to type? Let's type. Yay, section. And then let's post. Oh, cool, it happened. Like, it posted. Cool. Now, let's say there was a malicious hacker. Let's log me out now. Let's go back to our login page. Malicious hacker who's like, I saw that table. I see the usernames. I want to log in as, I don't know, Happy Cat or Rose or GLaDOS. So why don't we select this little thing here, just so I don't mess it up. And hopefully, you guys can ignore the bottom part. So that's not my password. It's not 3 characters. I don't get it. I don't understand. Well, I guess this is harder than it looks. Security, right? I swear, I tried this at home and it worked. I'll show you the database. Here you can see my database. Hopefully, I'm still logged in from last time. Possibly not. I have a users table. So you can see there's me. Oh, now you can see all my passwords because I didn't encrypt anything. Hopefully, good websites will do this. See the usernames and the passwords of all the people here. And then on the wall, you can see there are the comments, timestamp, messages. So that's what a SQL table might look like. And then you can sort of organize by, they're organized by these little columns. You can do things with that. Just letting you see, why doesn't this work? Maybe I'll come back to this. I swear it worked when I was at home. I was like, oh cool, I hacked my own website. But so going back to that some other time. Eek, oh no, running out of time. So hopefully, maybe another time it'll work and you will impersonate me. Who knows? So the thing that was in the comic, they sort of anticipated something like this. So sort of insert, they're trying to insert a student's name or something into a database. And then you can sort of see that for the variables, they anticipate, you know, like for my web page, I ask you to type in a message, yay, section, or whatever. And you can sort of craft a command here. This semicolon denotes that, oh, that's the end of that command, start a new command. And this new command is drop table. And somehow, if you found out that I called my that little wall thing, the table for the messages was called wall. And if you did this, you would effectively like delete it. But since I implemented my little web page in PHP, they have this they made the decision, the security decision, to not support multiple queries in one line. So if I actually tried this, it wouldn't work. Like really, it wouldn't work. Well, the other ones should have worked, because PHP doesn't support this multi-query thing. When I did a little bit of like history looking up, and they said it was because it was more secure this way. So yay, there are sort of things that are secure. And just so you guys don't get scared, even though that demo didn't work, I swear it worked at home. I don't understand, but this sort of thing, this injection. SQL injection attack can be easily sort of thwarted by just using another function that makes sure that that all the characters that you type in as your username and or your password cannot be used like in a command. So it makes sure that all the characters that you typed are just like those characters and they don't, you know, sort of have any like command value, or they can't be executed. So there's a neat little function that you can do that with. I, of course, left that function off. I still don't know why it's not working. But I don't get it. I don't understand. Anyway, maybe I'll fix it for you guys at some point soon. Cool. So questions? Comments? Oh, no, we're kind of a bit over. If you're interested, here's a bit of news. So apparently, SQL injection attack, even though it's easily thwarted, it still happens today. There was this attack, I think recently, where about 4 million sites were affected. They inserted sort of a link to some sort of spam website, and then sometimes, you know, users would be like, "Oh, cool! Here's a link. I'm gonna click it." So they probably inserted their URL into the database somewhere. So if you're interested, you can click that. And for those of you who checked out Google on April 1st. You might have seen their Google Motion for Gmail, where you sort of do all these silly motions, and then it sort of maps onto commands for your Gmail. Like you could, don't quite remember, but you can like send an email by like putting a stamp on it, or making the motion of like putting a stamp on it, on your hand, I guess. So you can check that out there. It's the second link, or third link, like total. But they meant it as an April Fool's joke, right? But some hacker, in the good way, some coder decided, hey, cool, this looks kind of cool. I'm going to take the Kinect, which is for the Xbox. It sort of it has software to sort of recognize your body positions and your motions. They took that, they changed some stuff, and now you can actually perform those silly motions, and it'll actually map to Gmail commands. So even though it was an April Fool's joke, Now you can actually do it if you have a Kinect and you know do a bit of hacking, I guess. So I thought that was cool. Funny stuff turns real. Whoa. So I think that should be it. If you guys have any questions or comments, please do ask. Or you can always email help, email me directly. You can use that anonymous website thing that I sent out or gave out or put on screen a few weeks ago. Or you can hang around and watch me try to make this thing work, try to break my own website. What? Well, I guess it's good that it's hard, right? Then, you know, that websites aren't so easy to break. But, yeah. Thanks for coming.